This is Nancy Emerson, and on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Library's Oral History Program, I'm here on May 1st, 2017, with Margaret Ketunen-Ziegart, a longtime Mill Valley resident who has made so many contributions to our town. We are in Ket's home at 118 Highland Lane in Mill Valley. Ket, I'm so glad to be here so that we can add your oral history to our collection. And I hope you're ready to tell us all about yourself. Before we get to the details, though, will you please tell me first about your name?
My name, I was born Margaret Jean Ketunen. K-E-T-T-U-N-E-N is a Finnish name. N-E-N means belonging to. Ketu means fox. I didn't realize that it was originally Ketu, and then the nen, N-E-N, did not mean belonging to. It meant like a fox. And so my ancestors were actually people who were well placed in Finnish society and contributed a lot to this small country in the north of England in Scandinavia.
Great. And how did it turn out that you go by Ket rather than Margaret?
Ketunen, short for that, is Ket. My father was always called Ket. So until I went to college and began signing my artwork, Ket, I was always still Margene, which was the family name for me. Because an aunt came and she thought Peggy Jean was not sophisticated when I was not even yet one. So they changed my family name to Margene. All my high school friends and early college friends still call me Margene.
But you adopted Ket as an artist, and then you've kept it.
Yes, because in the art department, they called me Ket. And when I went to New York City, I signed my artwork always Ket.
Great. Well, since we've touched on it, why don't we start with your early days? So where were you born and what was your family like?
I was born in East Lansing, Michigan, a college town. My father was the state 4-H club leader by the time I was born, and his offices were in the campus of Michigan State College then. He had gone to the school when it was a Michigan Agricultural College, and now it's called Michigan State University.
Great. And your parents emigrated from Scandinavia? Oh, sorry.
My grandparents, Ketunens, came from Finland, and my mother's grandparents came from Sweden. And Johansson, there were too many Johanssons, and so they would say at immigration, where did you live? And they said Almere. So they took the name Almere, and he was a minister from Sweden. First took for 2 years his congregation to northern, some part, I believe, in Minnesota. And then they moved to Oregon, out Gresham, Oregon, where he had a church for many years. My daughter and I first visited the site of my mother's home. She would say that when she visited her grandmother, she could see three mountains from the home, and it was nicely sited very near the Columbia River. And Gresham is just outside of Portland as well. My grandfather was a really significant person in his community, and my grandmother had come also from the Swedish families. They met, my grandfather met in Oregon, in Salem, at the first mental hospital where they both worked. And he was sort of a gallivanting, always entrepreneur, searching out new things, and had been educated because he and his sister, Aunt Mary, were the first graduate from Willamette University, and he also went to school in Willamette, and I'm not sure if he graduated, but in any event, he became superintendent of schools in a town called Shanico. He ran a ferry across the Columbia River. He mined for gold in Alaska. He ran engineering on a railroad, many different kinds of things, but he ended up owning large portions of land called Dry Wheat Farm. And so that's where my mother was born, in Kennewick, Washington. She would spend about 3 years out on the dry wheat farm. When I first visited there, it was 126 in the summer. And one of her stories is that when she was a little girl, it was very hot, she was very tired, very wanting to get cool, and so she jumped in the horse's trough.
This is recording number two with Kit Ziegart.
When I lived in Mill Valley, I have memories of all the things I did in San Francisco, and then all the things I did back in New York City. And when things always were very dim for me, a lot of different pressures, I would think, oh, I could go back to New York City and pick up where I was and be an artist. But then I decided, no, I'm going to stay here and enjoy Mill Valley because it's a wonderful community to live in. I went at the end of my teaching career, not really at the end, but one of the highlights of the end of, towards the end of my teaching career, was a Fulbright teaching exchange when I went to England and I taught at Testwood, which is a river on one side of the Southampton Sound, and on the other side, the Itchen side, is where I lived on grounds that had been a stately home that had been converted into an apartment. And the exchange art teacher that I had did not place me in her home, which is what they usually do, but I had a barren apartment, a new apartment that was furnished with an army cot without anything and a set of dishes. So it was a kind of a different experience for me because I had envisioned the kind of England that I had seen when I had visited there once when I went from Newcastle down around. And on that trip, I had gone, first of all, to Finland the summer after my daughter died at the advice of Henri Boussy, who was a wonderful teacher that I had in the art department at Tamil Pius High School. And he and his wife were wonderful people, supportive people, and gifted, both of them. And Henri suggested that since I was going to be teaching weaving, because he was leaving and his weaving program, that I should go to a weaving program in Scandinavia. So I went to a weaving summer program in Finland. Well, the only thing is that they draft just backwards from what we do in America. Sweden likes, like we have here in America, but not in Finland. But I did learn how to weave. The surprising reason that I was doing the weaving is because I went in the second half semester of teaching at Tamil Pius High School, and there were no roll sheets in my little cubicle. And we always got these roll sheets. It said instead, please see the principal. I thought, oh heavens, what's happening now?
Can I just ask you what a roll sheet is?
The roll sheet has all the students' names, which are for each class, and we usually had five classes. Some teachers had an extra session, but we had five programs a day, and they were always varied. I taught everything in the art department except art metal, which was very well done by Don McCallion, who'd also early on had done ceramics. And in those days, the glazes were just done here and there and didn't have any concern about their safety. And I think that was part of his problem when he was ill for so long and then passed away. And then we had this wonderful, in fact, he was a mentor to me, Henri Boussy, whom I mentioned. Then we had the music people, Bob Greenwood, and he later became the art department chair, and a lot of different people over the years. Tam were exceptionally gifted in their area. Bob Sherman in social studies. And Chuck Crawford is a special person. He was a counselor for one of my sons, John, and became his lifelong friend, wonderful man, and was a counselor. For 1 year, he was an assistant or principal, perhaps, but he decided he really wanted to be with the young people. And then we had many, many neat people. And just the other day, I met a son, Chris, who was the son of one of my colleagues in the counseling department, Beattie, Chris Beattie. And Chris was just a student, a friend of a neighbor's, and a friend of my children. So the whole Mill Valley scene has a beginning and an end and a middle, and I'm glad I didn't leave and go back to New York City, but my dream is still to go back another time and to visit the museums. And a friend is giving me the New Yorker magazine for the last 2 years, and I have a pile of them. I can't keep up with them. If they maybe came once a month, I might do better. But the Smithsonian comes once a month, and I can get that read. But I'm not always able.
Let's pin down your time at Tam High School. You started there in what year?
Well, I began teaching, I think, in 1961, and I'd retired from the classroom in 81, but then for 5 years I was what they called a mentor. And that was in 1981. And they're trying, I yesterday met a wonderful person at a service for Peggy Hewitt, who was the secretary to the social studies department. And Peggy later became a Chamber of Commerce for Mill Valley leader. And then she was very active in the Outdoor Art Club, which I joined. At the end of my teaching career, I said, I'm neither going to belong to the Outdoor Art Club or the League of Women Voters. I want to go to the Outdoor Art Club because they have teas. My mother used to have teas in our family garden. I mentioned my father's rock, but I didn't mention the flat areas. And my father had bent grass, and that was very unusual in Michigan. And it was always weeded and always a lovely carpet. And the college special things often were in my parents' backyard.
And their beautiful garden was a good venue for these.
Yes. a flat garden, mm-hmm. And then a hill slope. The yard, I wish I could have something like that here, but I do have birch trees. And I went skipping way back to when my children were little. They were very small, and I was pregnant with my last child. And I went, having lived in San Francisco for 3 years, in two marvelous places, actually. One was at Hyde and Green Street, 1201 Green Street, and the other was a floor-through apartment on over the Broadway tunnel. And it had a magnificent view. And at that time, in order to have an even income, because if you're married to a photographer who does commercial photography, you have things in spurts. And in order to have an even income, although I had already graduated with a teacher's credential, I had these small children, so I taught, only practiced teaching in Oakland at Claremont Junior High School, and then at Oakland Tech High School. But I had to have something that was not during the day when Harold would have been busy. So I worked at night, and sort of in between pregnancies, or, you know, the crucial months of pregnancies, at the Bank of America. And we had check-proof computers, and they were huge. They were almost the size, only on the end, of my Square Grand, my Chickering Square Grand 1864 piano, which is a treasure to me. Well, they were very big, and we worked at night. And by meaning we, most of the people working there were wives of musicians who were there for the same reason that I was. They wanted some kind of a steady income, not just the gigs, or else they were interested in having a night job. And we walked to the job, but we came back in taxis from the Bank of America office out on Montgomery Street. But when I came to from San Francisco to Mill Valley, my daily almost trips into San Francisco's hospital, UUSF, on Parnassus Street, was by public transportation. I didn't learn to drive till after my fourth child, Jamin, was born in 1959, 4 weeks after I started taking a driver's training course at Tam High School. And the teacher was someone who had been born in the town adjacent to the farm in Michigan where my father grew up, which is called Nagani. So there's just so many ways things cross. I have been great appreciation. After some years there, they decided it was too much. They had given me always the first appointment. But when I had four little children, not just three, they decided that I should have T.G. Brown for my teacher. I mean, not my teacher, but my doctor. And T.G. Brown charged me the same rate that I was getting at the clinic. So she made no profit on me. Now, but I could call up T.G. Brown. And as I was going to school, some kid, one of my children, would have something. And she'd say, well, bring them down before school and let me check them off to be sure they don't have strep. So many years they were getting strep, and it turned out we had a carrier, a strep carrier kid whom they played with, because at Kaiser they didn't give them, they gave them pills rather than inoculations, and they continued to be a carrier. So that went on. They come back home from school, don't need to worry, or bring them down and we'll give them all
a shot. So we should clarify that T.G. Brown was a physician who was located here in Mill Valley, right?
Yes, she was located in Mill Valley. She was a beloved physician for many
years, yes. But she made it easier for you to get your kids to the doctor.
Yes, she was a wonderful teacher. A wonderful
doctor.
Yeah. And Dr. T.G. Brown gave my son the opportunity to buy very reasonably her car, which was a Volkswagen Bug that had an open section, and this rocking chair you see over here by the piano that I treasure was brought by my son from Arizona with part of it sticking out of the car to me, and it's a treasure for me. But there's so many great things that she did for every family.
Wow. Yeah. Fortunately for you. Before we leave the idea of Tam High School, where you taught for 20 years, you were teaching in the 60s and 70s, 1960s and 1970s, when it was really an interesting social change time.
It was a social time of all what, time.
Any stories about that, those times?
Well, for an example, Bead Theater was a sort of a drug hangout, and Bob Greenwood once said, when we went to the service for Dan Caldwell, commemorating service for him, he said, you know, I really don't think that everybody knew what it was like, but we overlooked many things, and so that we were able to help so many other young people. And another thing that I must say about that time, the Methodist Church welcomed and assisted many young people, and they could sleep. And the Catholic Church also had meals for them, but the Mill Valley Library kept them, you know, occupied. And in those days at the library, you had to check out through a machine to be sure you weren't taking books, because many of the
people, the kids, this was part of their ethic, that they would take books. Mm-hmm. Some places they even ripped pages out, especially in New York, in San Francisco, rather. Mm-hmm. They did that. I don't think too many of them did that, but they had no place to be, especially in inclement weather. So they'd hang out at the library. And the thing that I always did was, outside of my room, I've taught in Phoenix, they now call it. It was one of the first rooms built when the school was built, I think in 1904, maybe, 1906. It was one of the first buildings, Wood Hall, and then the building that they call Phoenix now, up in what later became known as the Freshman Court. There was the classroom and there was a space. And when the kids came stoned, instead of saying they couldn't come to class, I had them make a patio. They went up. We had a cement that people had breaking up rows in repair. I think my children and I picked up some of the cement slabs, but the kids did also. And they made a patio, and they could sign in for class and do the work outside of the classroom. And, you know, whatever work they could do, they did outside the classroom. And that time I also taught some classes in ceramics. And I was thinking the other day, they made, the word just doesn't come to me right now, but the pipes, they made pipes. But as long as they did the assignments, they did that, they could come in at noontime and do things like that. So you knew things were going on, but in order to keep kids in school and to keep them stable, and really enjoyed their creative thrusts and were critical of some of the things they were doing, especially the drug use, and some of our faculty even had different ideas that they were transcribing. But basically, we were always very supportive of our students. And when I first was there, we really had a faculty-run school because we had a principal who was a marvelous man, but he really let the teachers do the curricula. And we had a Prather, Bob Prather. He was a very good principal in one regard, but not like some of the Redwood, John Krebs and people, had a different administrative focus, but we were very fortunate, and so we were a great collegial and leadership-driven faculty.
Now, was that true for the entire 20 years you were there,
did it change? Bob Prather's.
Okay, so then after the next principal who came started changing things?
Well, when we had, the reason, there was lots of principals later, and the reason we had lots of principals because we had a committee, and anybody who gets an excellent recommendation after 2 years or 2 or 3 years as a leader in a school, beware. Same thing for ministers. You beware, because they get these excellent recommendations if they've been there a short time, because they want to have them move on. Uh-huh. And so we had some very strange principles in terms of what we had before, but always the highest standards. When I got my teaching credential at University of California, Berkeley, there were 3 districts that we were told were the excellent districts. One of them was Tamalpais High School, one was Claremont, and one was East Whittier. And when I did begin teaching, my first year of teaching was in East Whittier. But then there was an opening up here in my home. We'd already had my home here that we'd rented out for a year. So I was able to come back and bring my family back here where I'd lived, you know, before Harold and I separated. We didn't get a divorce for over 10 years, but we separated just because I really had all I could do with 4 children.
So I guess I didn't realize that that you were a single mom to 4 kids and a full-time teacher.
Yeah, for many years.
For many years.
Yes.
For your children,
yes.
Most of their lives,
yes.
Really, yes.
But their father came every weekend. It wasn't that he wasn't involved in the family, but he literally, you know, was an artist. One of the things I told my students, in fact, I think I told them two things, but one was, if you want to be an artist, don't ever marry an artist. And that is a very true thing. So they should remember that all their lives and tell their own children that. And it's strange because I think my grandchildren maybe are going to end up to be artists. And so I think it's going to go on because the creativity, I was told, I think by someone that it's a DNA, a very strong DNA, creativity is a very strong DNA
to be
passing on.
Yeah. Because so, you have talked about how much in your family
it is. And so
I
have that. Mm-hmm. And my father also was very organized. He was an excellent administrator. In fact, during the war years, because he was involved with young people in agriculture, he wasn't drafted during World War II. But many of the firms that he used to help fund his programs wanted to have him as their executives, but he always refused. But he was he recognized he was a founder of the International Farm Youth Program and recognized by the United States government and did it. And after the war, he was sent to different countries to evaluate how their programs for agriculture and how they could relate positively.
Do you know which countries he went to?
Well, certainly Scandinavian. And the ones I know that the farm youth people, I remember him saying that you would have a young person from the deserts of Africa go to Australia, and then they would go, I mean, not Australia, go to Arizona. And then the Arizona kids would go to Africa, and they would learn as an exchange, and they would learn from both. And so it was the value of, he recognized the values of the existing cultures and then ways to look to the future. And my father started the programs in the 4-H Club, which was an international program, urban programs. He started the conservation programs, as I mentioned before. And he was involved in working with other departments. One of our close family friends was O.E. Reed, who later became the head of the dairy program for the country. And when my father took this boy and the girl who were outstanding in Michigan to the national 4-H program, 1 year, my brother would go to Washington, D.C., because we'd be the fifth person in the car. And another year, I would go. And so I did go to the National Art Gallery, and I did go to Chevy Chase's home of O.E. Reed that was next door to Hoover, Edgar J. Hoover. And the thing I remember about Edgar J. Hoover's home was I had never seen koi, these wonderful fish. And they were as large as they are at the Oakland Art Museum. And all these kinds of things are great memories that I have always associated with art. Also, I took an art class probably when I was in fourth grade from Miss Getch and Miss Winkler, who were teaching art at the College of Michigan State for youth. I don't think I took it very long, but I remember that they always wore smocks. And I must not have liked them very much because when I became pregnant, I never wanted to wear a smock. So I never wore a smock. And in those days, if you were pregnant, you almost always wore smocks. But Miss Getch and Miss Winkler had this wonderful house that I visited later. And it was a Frank Lloyd Wright house. And made me always wish I had the money to have a contemporary home. But right. I never have.
Right.
But I've seen so many of them, and especially in these Marin magazine and throughout I'm not able to go on the Outdoor Art Club garden tours, but the art club is the thing that I chose instead of instead of the American University Women. But I have I get each month I get their magazine, or so whatever.
So you can stay up with their activities.
Yeah, so I do get their magazine. Yeah.
Let's segue into talking about you as an artist. We talked a little bit about your printing, but that you also said that both you and your husband couldn't be artists at the same time. So you had to put that on hold for a while.
I did. And I haven't done anything like I used to do in New York City, but I still do a little bit. Mm-hmm. I've been on the art committee for many years at the church that I go to, which is the First Unitarian Universalist Church in San Francisco. And I belong to a wonderful organization called Center for Learning and Retirement. And initially, we were given tuition-free courses at the University of California Extension. Then we were given special rates to take a class on the ordinary faculty taught programs. Then we had the extension programs that we were able to go, and the extension programs gave us free rooms, and it was a group maybe over 250 people. Now I think maybe there were 40 people left, because they don't the draw for having young people is always to have something that they can have profitably to themselves. And the courses for us when we were young people, of course, were the ones that were offered by the University of California. But then we had peer classes taught by our members. Most of all of them were very professional people. Initially, I went to the program that San Francisco State had, but it was mostly teachers and not professional people. And there is a difference in the kind of learning that elementary school generally teachers have. Now, I enjoy teachers, and for many years I was on the board of the Marin Retired Teachers Association. And I still try to go to at least one meeting of their four meetings a year, sometimes more. But there are certain, instead, I'm now going more to things like Marin Coalition. And recently, I've started going to the Marin Philosophers Association because they have very interesting programs. And so I'm always interested in learning. I think that's one characteristic of mine that may be significant, I don't know. But in addition to that, I hope to finish projects I started. You asked about the kind of thing I did after and during the time that I was teaching even. But after I was teaching, I began doing more prints again. And I would use the printing, first of all, I used the printing studios at schools, and for San Francisco State University, I was able to go in. You could spend the whole day, you could work at night, as long as you wanted to, in their print room. So I did lithographs there. Not truly lithographs, I'm sorry, I used lithograph inks and did monoprints there on their lithographic presses. And I also, so I did some series there, and then I did a series called Creation. I did a series which was the Book of Genesis. One of the things I have not done that I wanted to do when I retired, that I was going to have time, I was going to read the Bible, because growing up in that interdenominational church that I mentioned in East Lansing, when I was a freshman in college, I just didn't have much time. And I did an interesting thing. I tried to figure out how I was using my time. And I was spending 20 years at the church teaching, you know, class and all kinds of things. So I just stopped having anything at all to do with the church so that I could, you know, do these other things. But then when I started having a family, Harold was Jewish, and I had this very loose economical
Ecumenical. I think is the word, yeah.
All the ickles.
Yeah.
I had that program. And so I was on the art committee almost ever since I joined. And one of the other things I did, especially there, was I made worked on the stone soup that other people were having initially. And if you know the story of the stone soup, it's the little boy that had brought a stone to put in the soup so everybody could bring something, and he brought a stone. And so they had soup instead of everybody hoarding and thinking only of themselves. Well, people began to not bring the best vegetables and the best things, but as they got older, they were bringing the things that weren't quite so fresh. So stone soup sort of evolved to the point where you would go out and buy the ingredients for the soups. Then I added, when the persons that were, I initially was on the program aspect of that, and we would have outstanding speakers on different subjects. That became the forum at the program at our church, which is just before the service. And our stone soup was once, was after the service. Then I began doing this myself, and I would buy all the things, and I would get, I fortunately was driving in those days, and I would get the Jack and Jill, I think it's called, or wonderful, I can't think of what you call it. It's a marvelous dessert. What could it be? Well, anyway, they have some in circles, but generally it's a large circle. Cheesecake.
Jack and Jill, huh? Something to do with cheesecake.
I think it's not quite Jack and Jill. Okay. It's Jack and something or another. Jill and something or another.
Okay.
It's right near the Humane Society.
Oh, the name of the bakery where you could pick it up.
Well, it isn't a bakery. Okay. They only make cheesecake.
Okay.
Only make cheesecake. Okay. And you get it day old.
Okay. In San Francisco.
No,
in
San Rafael.
North
of San Rafael, almost near Novato.
Yeah.
Anyway, where the Humane Society Street is. And then I would get large cans of things like tomatoes or shrimp or whatever. And I would make a salad and a soup and then the dessert. But initially, we would get day-old bakery things, but the group became larger than the bakeries would have less day-old things they were, to give away to the church. Mm-hmm. But that's one of the things I did at the church, as well as many other things. But
let's just touch back on art for a second, because you were the recipient of the Millie Award.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about that.
That's a very special thing that was started. Bob Greenwood was one of the initial people that started that program. Abby Wasserman was another, and they are significant people in our community in the arts. And you were given in different areas, the literary and visual arts. And there are so many people that received this. Music was, of course, one of the fields. And Joe Aguilo was also early on working with Bob Greenwood. And he had the middle school very strong music program. And people that were very strong in the community, like Phyllis Faber, who still is active in Malt and in West Marin. And there's another person called Jeannie Chandler, whom I have gotten to know quite well through conversation. She told me the other day, called her the mayor of the pool, but she is a great creative person, a flautist, and for different medical reasons, she became interested in art, and she's a very proficient representational artist who spends many, many hours working out art things. And of course, I have an entirely different background, because I, in addition to the program that I had at Michigan State, when I was in New York City, it was during the heady 50s, and Hans Hoffmann had influenced. I didn't know Hans Hoffmann, but all of my friends around 8th Street knew him. When I went to New York City, I didn't really know anyone. I had an aunt that wasn't really close to my family, who had been an artist for Vogue magazine many, many years ago, and she lived in New York City. But I, for some reason or another, the aunts and my father weren't close. And although my father had worked 2 years after school, of 2 years, as a teacher in order to help put the girls through school, the art school, his whole feeling about me going to New York and becoming an artist, well, he actually disowned me. But we had a great family friend named Joe Alexanian, and these rugs from my family are from his store, and he had an Armenian background. And he and my parents were perhaps, and his wives were perhaps the closest friends they had, although my family had a lot of friends. But Uncle Joe went to visit me, and apparently he went back and told my father, I hadn't changed a bit. I was the same Margene that I was. I hadn't become a corrupted artist. So he, my father sort of accepted me.
He reconciled with you then, yes.
I guess he reconciled, you know, that I was all right.
Yeah.
And my mother, to my dismay, I received letters from the ones that I had written her when I first went to New York, but also she had published the letters that I had written to her and the information, like social occasions in the Lansing newspaper. But in the end, it turned out to be quite useful because I had no idea of the different things I'd done over the years that I was in New York City because I didn't keep track. But she had kept track through, and through the newspapers. I had a wonderful friend named Sari Broner, who was the daughter of one of my colleagues, and she, and also my oldest granddaughter, Liana Leah Ziegart, the daughter of my son Benjamin, worked and they organized all my prints, and it was enabling me to make my website. And most of the work is from the time when I was either in New York City, but then I did work, as I mentioned, right after my daughter passed away, then I had more time. And so I went, and then when I left school also, I went to courses at San Francisco State and used their press. Then I've now spent many years also using the press at the classes at College of Marin in the community programs, regular, not the community college, but they had community people taking regular classes. And I liked being around young people so much that this was, to me, a great thing to do. So I did the printing there until about 4 years ago, and then they changed and you couldn't enroll in the programs because the state had made different requirements, and I didn't want to go to the community courses because they were just old people, and I wanted to be around young people. But the nice thing was that I did have the opportunities to use the presses so I could continue doing my printmaking. And my printmaking basically is engraving on copper. And I think I have, you told me of one other place, venue where my work is held, but I had purchase awards, and then for other ways they must have purchased them after I left New York. Well, probably left a lot behind. I think I'm in 35 different museum exhibitions over the years.
Wonderful.
So I have had a good background, and But here, and people to be nice have suggested that I have a show in a store or something, and I just, that is not what I want to do.
But now you are involved currently with the O'Hanlon Center, right?
No, the O'Hanlon Center, they have they have juried shows.
Okay, and have you showed
there? Just this last year, I showed this print and two of my recent prints.
This print is the triptych on her beautiful piano.
This being, and my Millie Award is up there. It's a wonderful little sculpture.
Yes.
And I also have up there a very fine silk double weaving from China. And the Nixon was given one of those after he went the first time. I went to China before that. My mother, who was adventuresome like her father was, and she was also strong-willed, she wanted to go to China because her sister, my aunt, had been traveling all around the world because she was the first lady ham operator. And in 1936, when we visited, she had a tower in her backyard. At the time, we also visited one of my aunts, Ketnan aunts, who lived in Pacific Grove. And the thing I remembered most about her house was that she had an organ, a real pipe organ in her house. So I have, you know, all kinds of memories. My children say I should write a memoir. Mm-hmm. So they'll be glad to know that I'm doing this. And I hope to edit it and put it in some kind of order because I am picking up different strands as I recall things. But I have traveled a lot. And after I left school, in addition to doing the printing and the artwork, I would go on trips. Once we counted up, and I went on a couple more times after that, but once we counted up the elder hostels that I went on, or everybody was, and I'd gone on 17. But I'd go on an elder hostel to meet people, and then I'd travel by myself to go to places because very few people want to spend a lot of time in an art museum or going to an art museum or going to places where painters had been.
But you do.
But I did. And the other thing I did that was, I hope people still do, is the universities offer summer programs. And then again, you're around young people. This is the thing to do. Mm-hmm. You go to a summer program, and I went to one through University of California in Paris, and we had the head of the Sorbonne, who was our leader, our artist, from the art department. It was a wonderful 4-week program. Then I went to Hayward University, which is now East Bay University, I think. And the program there was a 6-week summer program. And we had to take a full semester course. And it was, we had a program in academically in economics. Was one of my classes, and then something else. When we got there, it was just when the euro started. And she said, we have to change the whole course, and I don't have any course of study because this has just happened. So we read The Economist as our textbook. And anyway, I had then art courses taught, and we had a membership to all the all and city museums. But the Monet, I would go to the Monet Museum, which was a private museum, 2 or 3 times. I've been to Giverny maybe 2 or 3 times. And I have just wonderful memories about all these art experiences. And even when I was traveling from a different program, and I went across into Belgium And I went to a small town which had a wonderful art exhibit, and it was the first time I saw painting like my painting. You know, I always painted in a little different way than most people painted. But in any event, I was, I even have a, maybe you can find a sheet of paintings. I only painted for 1 year. But the year, I think 1953, and in 1954, I had an invitational showing of my art at the Legion of Honor, of my print, of my paintings. And the Achenbach collection, they purchased one or two prints early on, but then I've given them prints over the years, several prints, which I've painted, printed since I left New York. But I do still have lots of things in my mind to do.
But can I just clarify these classes and seminars that you took, the month or 6 weeks or whatever, were those after you retired from TAM?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So you were very busy from your retirement till now.
I keep very, very busy because now the Outdoor Art Club has wonderful programs. And I've always been on the Civics and Conservation Committee there. But I hope you become a member. Are you interested in becoming a member of the Outdoor Art Club?
We'll have to talk about that.
If you are, the Outdoor Art Club has a waiting list. They have over 400 members. And if you find a woman's organization that has 400 members in these days, you know that there's something really wonderful in addition to being the Maybeck Building.
Oh, yes.
It is a wonderful organization. Mm-hmm. We have brilliant young people coming in. And of course, Mill Valley has changed a bit. And it's, someone today said something, and they said, Mill Valley is an entitled community. And I think that's the difference of attitude, because we have a different attitude in Marin County now. We still have the wonderful people who are here. But our Marin Magazine, for an example, shows you the level of living style that many people can afford. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, there is still the balance of the old timers who live in communities, and they give their homes to young people of their own. So we have those young people coming in that have the values that we have always had in Mill Valley, so there is a nice balance. And TAM High School, of all the schools, the three schools in the district, I think was the best school possible, because as I said, we had Bob Prather for the initial principal, and we had an opportunity to have the kids from Valinas, who were a different strata during the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. They had names like Heather, Summer, you know. And they had wonderful parents that were very free and creative. And their program, their schooling program, was very creative. And they were always very capable. When the tide was up, the kids, if it was a beautiful day, there wouldn't be the boys, because they'd be out surfing and then they'd come the next day. We had the most responsible Texiera boy, and the families that had the Portuguese farms, ranches. The Texiera boy, for an example, they'd get up at 5 in the morning and help milk the cows, mm-hmm. and then they'd come into school, and then they'd go home. So they weren't able to participate in the school things, but in the classes, they still contributed. And I remember Bob Sherman, no, it wasn't Bob Sherman, it was John Nicholson, another outstanding teacher, who said, we have streaming and it's wrong. It's wrong because you segregate kids on your expectations for them. And I'm afraid they're going back to this again, and it's a wrong thing to do. Because as John Nicholson said, you have someone from Marin City who has insight and experience and actual life encounters that you won't get if you've been brought up in a different middle class or upper class in the environment, you know, the stratification. And we didn't have that at TAM. We had an integrated kind of population. And in my own community here, when I'm living in unincorporated Mill Valley, I'm living in the unincorporated county. My address is Mill Valley, but we never had the real estate pressures that they had elsewhere. And from the time my children were 3 and 4, we had 2 families on my street of maybe 8 homes, 2 families that were Asian. And they were wonderful, wonderful families. Blanche was a designer for one of the department stores in San Francisco. Her husband was a gifted sculptor who had worked with Islam Noguchi, a very prominent and well-known sculptor, worked in his studio. We had another one was an architect, and his wife had worked for an outstanding ceramist in Corte Madera. And she was from Korea and had been in Japan during the Korean problems, and has been a neighbor for many years and passed away recently. But their children now are middle-aged, as my children are, and important in their different fields. But they all started out as a part of Mill Valley. And you asked about TAM High School then. This was at the time when there were the riots. And in one summer, there was going to be, through information, through breakthrough, and to the students of TAM High School, and now they call them of color, but they basically they were black students of Marin City and others, to not do any rioting or parading, because the president had set aside and was preparing naval housing and military housing to bring these people and to not do anything that would get them into trouble. Mm-hmm. So they didn't. But this was the word that was passed around to the young students, and I'm not sure everybody knows that.
Now, do you recall, was that the 60s or the 70s?
This was the 70s.
The 70s, yeah.
When, after the riots in Los Angeles.
Oh, right. Okay, 80s.
And we had 90s. 2 teachers, Ruth Slusser and I, and we would break up the fights of the girls because they kept... razor blades in their hair, but the boys had chains, but the girls would fight because the black boys now were dating white girls, because there were many young people who were really, really adventuresome and liberal, and they were courageous against pressures. They were all of the kids. That's why I like young people so much. That's why I don't want to be in groups of old people. And that's one of the nice things about the Outdoor Art Club. They're young people, of not a student, you know, they're mature young women, but they're of all ages. And that's why something that was so great, like Center for Learning and Retirement CLEAR, had to close. This April was the last time of the meetings. They had to close. They only had 40 people left. And, you know, we started out with maybe 250. But the Outdoor Art Club has grown because it is a welcoming of all ages. And probably, to me, I used to be on the board some years ago. And one of the things we decided then was that some people were joining so that they could have the rent adjustment as members for weddings and for funerals and special occasions. So we decided that they couldn't have those until after 2 years. And after 2 years, they had to have service. And the thing that they do is they work for in the 20 hours, I think it is, they put in different ways. But often they work in the kitchen, and they have these teas, and they have the luncheons that are once a month. Mm-hmm. Well, the teas, you can't believe the teas. I have a friend with whom I have many, many happy things that we've done together, who lives at the Towers, and she would take me to special events that the museums and the symphony would have, for which she was a special donor. And these teas outdo their teas. They are fantastic. This last one, well, you can't believe them. But our last luncheon was the most exquisitely prepared visually and taste-wide luncheon that I'm sure if you had had it out at the public at large, it probably would have been a one menu, $300 experience. It was visually, it was just astounding.
Everything, and these are prepared by the women members. Not paid chefs.
Oh no, outdoing chefs. Yeah, outdoing sounds like chefs. It. And the teas, people bring things, you know, but they seem to outdo each other. And the flowers, we have one person, Boston, she
Patty Boston.
Yes, she does these, was doing these fantastic arrangements, but now they all are, and they all are outstanding. And then if you're very fortunate, you might be able to take home for $5 one of the centerpieces and feel that you were really lucky, because although there may be 6 or 8 people at the round tables, you know, would not necessarily be able to take one because somebody else had gotten their dibs first. So it's been a very interesting program. And the nice thing about it is, as I said, I've been on the Civics and Conservation program, and we have the most wonderful colic that we read when somebody passes away, and there are many, many, many wonderful members that have gone. But we also have many goals, and there was a shift maybe 2 or 3 years ago with young people, and so we're becoming more, quote, up to date, and we still are a volunteer organization. We're not a profit organization, we're nonprofit, so we have some constraints for that, but our new focus is to go back to the original goals of the Outdoor Art Club, which are to become involved in the community. And the first things they did was, for an example, they started the first library. Mm-hmm. And they had a World War II hospital facility in their building. And when there's an earthquake, they are an earthquake place.
Shelter.
And they co-sponsor with the Historical Society a walk once a year. And they are now trying to be more actively involved. This is their goal. We're actively involved with the different community organizations. And this year, one thing that they have received publicity for, and to me, I don't think you'd have to have publicity for doing the good things, but to them it's important, the young people, it's important to have the publicity. Mm-hmm. But we've been doing good things all along.
Yes.
But now, for an example, we had a clock that we helped restore and had the publicity about it. And apparently that's the one thing young people do, but this is a way that they pass on the original intent, mm-hmm, and relate to the community. So we're having a meeting next Thursday of our Civics and Conservation to find more ways to relate to the organizations that we've been giving a small token gift to from our particular club. But we have an outreach program where we give major and minor gifts to organizations. And so that's a monetary thing that we do, and we raise the money for that. Principally, we don't take, and I hope we never do, but we probably will end up doing it, taking donations to our club from other entities, maybe Chamber of Commerce or something.
So currently your fundraising is within the club?
Right now, the Outdoor Art Club raises the money within the group, and we have a garden fair every other year, and they would just have had a garden tour, so I hope you've been able to go on those. Mm-hmm. And then the alternate year we've been having for the last 3 years, three times every other year now, a art program, an exhibit with sales, and so we'd raise money that way. And it also sort of ties in, because Outdoor Art Club, you know, it's people, where's the art? So this is where the art is. Yeah, although good. There's a program within our club, or there's an art program, there's a bridge program, there's games where you learn, you do all kinds of things. I mean, there are many different things. And one of the new things, a new member, you come in and you sit around a table and you meet new people. A new member of maybe 2 or 3 months has started a boutique pattern drafting, fashion, making garments. So we have a sewing club. And so I mentioned that one of my neighbors was really involved in the sewing club. And she said, well, that isn't it. And she said, this is something different than she told me about it. So they bring in new ideas and new things. So it's a growing institution mm-hmm. that isn't dying, mm-hmm. and we have people on the waiting list. So that's been a very...
And tell me again, when did you join it? After you retired?
After I retired, mm-hmm. I made the decision between the university women and the teas, and I mentioned perhaps that my mother had these teas in our backyard, and I always helped, you know. And to have to be at a tea and not having to help
to be the server
time.
or the maker.
And the other thing that my family did, they only entertained really once a year on Easter, and we probably had 40 or 45 different people come in groups, because there would be a sunrise Easter service, then there'd be an early Easter service, and then a later service, depending on what service you went to or what church. Mm-hmm. And, some people went down to Lansing, Michigan, to their Episcopal church, or they went to the Catholic church, or whatever church down in Baptist, maybe in Lansing, mm-hmm. or People's Church, or the early sunrise service. And my mother would bake quantities of blueberry muffins, and my father would squeeze, we didn't have orange juice in those days, he would squeeze oranges for a whole day ahead of time to have fresh orange juice. And then we would have Canadian bacon and eggs and blueberry muffins. And I would help serve.
So I'm hearing that people, depending upon what church service they went to for Easter, then afterwards they would come to your house for brunch.
Yes.
So you had a very busy
day.
So
that's my mother. Mm-hmm. And then my family always had bridge clubs. And here in Mill Valley, some of the people that I really admire play bridge.